I'm delighted to be here tonight to launch the Origin Speaker Series in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee. This gathering is intended to elevate the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and growers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish, shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses, and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that farmers and producers are doing in our area. The conversation is being held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore. Tonight's program will be all about locally made items for your pantry, salt, vinegar, and oil. We are pleased to welcome Paige Payne from J.Q. Dickinson Saltworks. Paige, along with her husband Lewis and sister-in-law Nancy Bruins, are seventh-generation salt makers. Their brine source is the 400-million-year-old ancient sea, the Iapetus Ocean. Sarah Canizio and Isaiah Billington, former pastry chef and chef de cuisine, respectively, of Woodbury Kitchen, recently founded Keep Well Vinegar. They use locally sourced grains, fruits, and vegetables to fuel their fermentation process. Josh Leidecker is the owner of Susquehanna Mills in Montoursville, Pennsylvania. Josh provides locally grown, non-GMO food oils that are mechanically pressed to create healthier oils that maintain higher levels of nutrients. Now I'd like to turn the program over to Dana Slater, the producer of the Origin Speaker Series.
Welcome to our 11th Origins.
Yay!
Very excited. Full house. Really happy to have you. Happy summer. Gone from 50 to 100 as we thought we would. Just wanted to read a quote that I thought might just put us in the mood for tonight. One cannot think well, love well, sleep well, if one has not dined well. So thought that was a good intro to tonight. So tonight, we're going to be talking about the pantry items, salt, oil, and vinegar. And we have a fantastic panel. I'm just going to run through their bios real quick, and then I like to always acknowledge everybody that puts this on behind the scenes that doesn't get the proper acknowledgement that they need to get each time. So I'll start with Isaiah and Sarah. So we have Isaiah Billington and Sarah Canizio. And you may recognize them. They've actually, Sarah was the baker or pastry chef, I guess we should say, pastry chef at Woodbury. And Isaiah was the chef de cuisine at Woodbury for many years. And as such, they developed strong relationships with farmers in the Chesapeake watershed. Today, they chose to support all those small local farmers via fermentation. The area's strength in growing grains, fruits, and vegetables provides plenty of fuel to make great soy sauce, miso, vinegar, and more. Their company is called Keep Well Vinegar and supplies those pantry items to restaurants in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. And I just want to say parenthetically, we have all the products that our makers and distillers make up here. We have the oil, the vinegar, and the salt. And afterwards, if you're interested in buying anything, we'll have a little small retail shop set up. So let's start. Let's go to Paige next. Paige, Paige Payne over there. Paige is with J.Q. Dickinson Saltworks. And Paige's husband, Lewis, and his sister, Nancy Bruins, are seventh-generation salt makers. Their fourth great-grandfather, William Dickinson, moved to the area in 1813 and was producing salt using a kiln by 1817. They're on the same farm today. This is in what town in West Virginia? Malden, West Virginia, not to be confused with... Not to be confused with Malden sea salt. It's E-N, right?
Right.
There we go. So they're on the same farm today that they were back then, and they're producing a solar-dried finishing salt. Their brine sauce is a 400 to 600 million-year-old ancient sea, the Iapetus Ocean. Paige has been involved in the operations side of the company, especially when she's in Charleston, West Virginia. When in Baltimore, which is great that we have her in Baltimore, she takes on the event planning, the accounts receivable, and a number of other aspects to keep the company running smoothly.
And personal delivery of salt.
Personal delivery of salt. And I actually carry around one of these guys in my purse. So they're great for that. So welcome, Paige.
Thank you.
Josh Leidecker over here drove down today from Montoursville, Pennsylvania, near Bucknell.
Is it?
Okay. and I'm just, this is sort of tongue-in-cheek. I said Josh took the straight path from making cooking oil, from making biofuel oil originally, to sort of generate power for his construction vehicles. So he'll talk a little bit more about how he went from that to cooking fuel. But Josh's goal in Susquehanna Mills is the name of his company. Is to provide natural cooking oils from locally grown crops. The varieties include canola oil, sunflower oil, hemp oil, and then they have blends. So they have hemp and sunflower oil, rapsol seed oil, and probably one or two that I'm not mentioning.
There's more.
Okay. So welcome.
Pumpkin seed oil.
There we go. Welcome, Josh. So let me just take a few seconds to thank everybody who helps put these together every month. Thank you to Hannah Reagan over there in the corner by the curtain. Magic behind the scenes always. So thank you very much, Hannah. Also wanted to thank the crew here. We have Chef David. He's cooking. Chef David in the kitchen. And actually, we have Chef Opie tonight from Woodbury. And Lauren Paven, Grace, and Patrick, who are a wonderful crew here, and they'll be serving you dinner tonight. So thank you to all of them. Let's see. Sean Noche is our flower lady. She provides these beautiful flowers for each month, and she's been doing it since the beginning, so I'd just like to give a shout-out. Her company is called The Floral Studio, if anybody's looking for a great florist.
We have the best flowers for any podcast.
Yeah. Hey, we may do some video later, so you never know. Mary Romeo on the back does our Facebook page. Like it, love it, share it. It's Origins, a speaker series, for any of you that haven't noticed it. And also, I just wanted to say that the last two podcasts that we did just went up on Heritage Public Radio. So I put those up on the page today. We did a January show on grains and a February show on sustainable seafood. So they're both up there for your listening pleasure. Also, if you do listen to it, again, like it, tweet it, talk about it, because we're trying to build sort of a wider audience for the show. So one quick thing just before we get on with the show, I wanted to call out Wendy Jeffries, who is the executive director of a new organization in town called Tastewise Kids. She's just going to talk for 2 minutes about the organization because it dovetails very well into everything we're trying to do. Okay, so without further ado, I'm going to turn the mic over to Spike, and here we go. Oh, actually, one other quick thing. So this is a podcast. We are recording tonight. If you have a question for newcomers, please raise your hand, and I will walk over Vanna White-like with the mic in hand. Do not shout out if you can help it. I know you get passionate about the topic, but if you can just hold it, and I'll get there real quick with the mic. Thanks.
Great, thank you, Dana. This is I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time, for many reasons. One of them is these are some of my favorite people in the whole world, and this is something I don't think that many people are talking about. As a chef, and probably for most of us, we probably cook with oil, salt, and vinegar just about every day. They're essential, I think, to cooking the way that I cook, for sure. And I think, because we cook with these kind of humble ingredients every day, there are probably three of the ingredients that we take most for granted. And we're very fortunate here in Baltimore, here in the Mid-Atlantic, to have at our in our pantry these incredible ingredients. I'm going to try to create a little order here, if possible. Sarah and Isaiah worked for years at Woodbury, as Dana said. Isaiah was really the first person we hired into the kitchen at Woodbury Kitchen, and had an amazing, just did everything that there was to do in that restaurant for almost 8 years, and And then Sarah came along and kind of took his place in the pastry kitchen. And that was an incredible contribution they made to Woodbury. And they're still contributing with these incredible vinegars. But I want to start with oil, because it was the first place, it was the first of these incredible ingredients that I got to use at Woodbury. And Josh was a guy that I met when I went up after I'd heard about what he was doing and visited his operation outside of Williamsport. And I'll kind of let you, I'm still thinking about that day. It made quite an impression, as you'll hear. But what I saw there, if you could just talk about it, and first of all, how we met maybe, but then what you're doing up there in Pennsylvania.
The embarrassing part?
Well, we want to get it all out there, so sure. I mean, yeah.
Okay, well, so Spike gave me a call one time and left a message. And I thought to myself, who's got a name of Spike? Like, really, is this somebody who's just calling me? So I didn't call him back right away, but he was definitely relentless. He called again, and he said, hey, I want to come up and check things out. So I said, all right, well, come on up. So he came up with his son, brought his son along, and he showed up, and I had my dog with me. Should I tell this part?
Yeah, just well.
This is pretty awesome. So I have an American Pitbull Terrier, which great dog, but they're kind of dog aggressive sometimes, and Spike rolls up and we say hello. The next thing I know, my dog is running out into the cornfield after another dog. So I'm like, hold on. And I run it out after and I tackle my dog, and Spike runs up, and there I am covered in dirt and blood and holding two dogs apart. And that's how kind of our
that's how we met.
It was kind of an interesting beginning, but the day really kind of turned out pretty nice.
Yes.
After that. So then we did a tour of my facility where we have German made expeller mills. So low temperature extraction of cooking oil. And then we went out and looked at some farms, and we went through some canola fields. Do we have sunflowers? I don't recall. Wheat fields and, you know, different, you know, like the real, this is where it comes from.
They were harvesting canola, which was one of the cool things.
Yes,
right. One of your growers harvesting canola.
That's right.
That day.
Yep. John Harvey was his name, yeah. I just talked to him this morning, actually. Awesome. And that's kind of how it began. And we were just trying to figure out where we were heading at that time. And mainly kind of where the business for me started. My father and I had a construction firm in Pennsylvania. We used a lot of diesel fuel. So I had a guy helping me in the office like 10 years ago, and he saw something on the internet that said, hey, you can make your own fuel for 46 cents. And I said, order that. So he ordered that stuff up, and it basically was a little booklet with some snake oil and some other, that you take this and you mix it with that, and voila, you've got biodiesel, which wasn't biodiesel. It was just really thinned down vegetable oil. But the story was I had the guts to try to make my own fuel, which was very empowering. So I went to Costco and I bought a jug of cooking oil, and I mixed their snake oil and all the ingredients and blah, blah, blah. And I was building a house for a guy in from California at the time, who had just bought a brand new Kubota tractor. And he said, oh, I've heard of biodiesel. Put that in my brand new Kubota tractor. So he had no idea whatsoever that I had not used this fuel on anything yet. So we dumped it into his new Kubota tractor, and we started it up. And it was kind of an amazing transformation where the diesel fuel left and the cooking oil began. And it smelled delicious. So we went to lunch and came back, and I said, well, heck, if he did it, I'll do it. So I dumped the rest of it in my pickup truck, and I've made my own fuel ever since that day. Was kind of the beginning of this whole thing. So that next year, we made 75% of our diesel fuel, made it ourselves, which was about $125,000 worth. So it was a pretty cool situation. So then it goes to the cooking oil. I'm getting there. I'm sorry. I had this friend. We were on a canoe trip going down the Loyal Sock Creek, which I live next to, and that's where our mill's next to. And he says to me, hey, I want to have a picnic next weekend. He said, can we cook a chicken, turkey, in that fuel you make? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know why. I don't know what makes cooking oil, rather than just oil. So we got a really clean bucket, and we siphoned some off of a really clean barrel, and we had two capons and some French fries, and man, it was good. It was really, really good. And that's kind of like where my friend asked if we could cook a turkey in my fuel. I mean, there it was. And that was the beginning of like, hey, we can make this. This is great. It's way better than making diesel fuel. We can make something delicious out of it. So that's kind of the beginning of the story. And then that has progressed into, we've got 5 different varieties of oil now, and Woodbury uses all of them. And there's some really exciting new stuff coming on, like the hemp and hemp blends. And there's new legislation coming that's going to allow us to cultivate hemp in Pennsylvania, which will kind of bring it closer to where we can process hemp, and we process sunflowers and canola now. But it's exciting. It's all like very exciting stuff to kind of come back to the beginnings of what cooking oils really should taste like, which is not really very American.
We should definitely talk about that. You know, the thing for me in meeting Josh was that, and Sarah and Isaiah might remember this, I was this close to trying to buy an expeller press and make our own oil at Woodbury. And I think it can be easy to kind of confuse the DIY mentality, which we have to an extent, with our intent to source locally. And thank God I met Josh, because when I finally saw what he was doing and how involved it was and the knowledge that he had about not only the expeller pressing of the oil seed, but also how to clean it up and make it useful for us, I'm really glad that I didn't go down that road. and it's also something that that practically we couldn't do at a restaurant like Woodbury, is produce the quantities that we need. We fry in his oil. It is the only oil. Josh's oils, I think, are the only vegetable oils that we use. We use a lot of animal fats, but I'm trying to just make sure I'm not telling a fib, but is that true?
Yeah, we only use Josh's
all right
oil.
Thank you. And there's no way that
we ran out.
Yeah, we,
good.
Yes. and that's amazing. And what I think this panel represents are three efforts to do things that we absolutely couldn't do. As much as we love to do at Woodbury, as much as we love to do for ourselves, we couldn't do what they're doing. It's irreplaceable for us. And I'd like to talk to Paige a little bit about, I had a similar experience. In fact, I visited with everybody. I practically lived with these two for about 5 years. But I got one of those emails that you just, you could never make it up. But this email, I happened to be out in Western Maryland. I got an email that said, hey, we're down here in West Virginia, and we're making our own salt. Would you be interested? And it was a very similar situation. I jumped in the car the next day. It turned out, even though I was in Western Maryland, it was still 3 hours away. I mean, West Virginia is a huge state. And got down and saw and met Nancy, Paige's sister-in-law, and had an amazing visit and saw the beginnings of JQD. Well, first of all, the site where it had always been,
right.
And then got to meet Nancy and see her process, the evaporation of the brine, and just we've been, I think, a steady customer, and it's. Can I say that that's the only salt that we use at Woodbury?
Yes.
Okay. And that was, I think, going on.
It must be about 2 years.
2 years,
Our well is 3 years old this month.
Okay.
So we're still a really young, new company, and it's been exciting, and 3 or so years of trial and error and history and family and chemistry and a lot of learning and a lot of fun experiences. But yes, you were the first chef to come down. You saw us in our infancy. We've learned a lot since then. But it's been really exciting. It's a unique opportunity to be able to revive a family business, much less one that is 200 years old, and to be on the same property as they were. Our cousins still own the farm where we are today, and they are equally as excited about what we're doing. So it's super special.
Can you just talk a little bit about you've got this incredible brine that comes up from the sea, as Dana talked about, and just describe your process a little bit.
So when we want brine, we dug a 350-foot well, because of course West Virginia is landlocked, so we had to dig for our ocean. Our ocean is the Iapetus Ocean. If you know mythology, Iapetus is the father of Atlantis, so it predates the Atlantic Ocean. So one thing that I think makes our salt a little different is that it's been protected for 400 million years. When we want the brine, we bring it out of the ground, we draw it from the ground, and pump it into 2 holding tanks. Our salt turns red almost immediately. It's got a lot of iron in it, and it oxidizes, so it turns to rust. We no longer want that metally taste in our food. So we let that iron drop out. Back in the 1800s, they made great red canal salt, which we actually made a little bit of red salt for the Civil War reenactors. They were very excited about it. But not so great for our food. Our palates have evolved. Goes into those two holding tanks, the iron falls out. That's our first byproduct of the salt making. We then take the salt, the brine, when it's crystal clear again, and pump it into two sun houses that do virtually the same thing. They evaporate. We want as much H2O gone. That's where the chemistry comes in. We want it very concentrated. Every time we draw brine out of the ground, we test the salinity. It's much like the ocean. It's about 4% salinity. And that's been consistent for the last 2 years. From the evaporation houses, we pump it into the granary. We don't want the grains to form in the evaporation houses. Once it gets into the granary, that's when the magic happens. These beautiful, white, perfectly square crystals form. It takes about 5 weeks when we draw the brine out of the ground till we bring the crystals into the processing room. We hand harvest these. It's all hand harvested. Jars are labeled by hand. It's a very small batch and family run. It's been amazing.
It's awesome salt. And April was a good month for you guys.
Amazing. This past April, not so great for the Midwest, but the Midwest, if you remember, held all of that weather in the middle of the country. We rely on the sun. We don't boil our brine down like they did in the 1800s. So this year, let's see, last year we made about 120 pounds in April, and this year we made 1,200. So we got off to a great start. We're really excited. One thing we really are trying to do this year is to make as much salt as we can with our present footprint, much like these other companies that are here today and that Spike deals with. We are very conscious of our environment. So before we built another sunhouse, we are on this beautiful piece of property that we don't want covered up with sunhouses or greenhouses. So what we want to do is see what as much salt as we can make with our present facilities. So that's our goal this year. We've gotten off to a good start, so we're excited.
Awesome. And so from oil to salt and now to vinegar, Sarah and Isaiah are, so we're in Pennsylvania and then we're in West Virginia with the salt and now we're in Washington, D.C., I guess, and other places. How's it going?
Pretty well. Vinegar is kind of a situation. Question of where you can make vinegar is where you can take up a lot of space for a long time. So we keep looking for more and more places where we can find ourselves being welcomed. and where people can take the smell of so much acetic acid. But we decided to get into this because after so much time at Woodbury, we found that there was one thing that we were really proud of, which had been sort of continuous over the course of 5 or 7 years, shrinking of the list of things that we ordered kind of pre-made, whether it had been at the very beginning, even some things like some dried fruit, and then down to sort of ground up spices and things like that. As the more that we could take it to a whole food, the closer that we could get to sourcing 100% from guys like Josh and Paige. So we were really proud of that, and we saw that there were some things that, some holes that needed filling, and one of those we thought was some more exotic fermentation processes, and vinegar certainly one of those. And then something that we thought that we could still continue to do better after we left Woodbury was to figure out how to contribute a lot more flavor to the basic pantry for many restaurants and for a lot of chefs in the scene. Not only just for simple sort of gustatory purposes, but also having both been pastry chefs and served so many mountains and mountains of icing and sundaes and cakes, I think we thought it would be great for us to help people push a lot of flavor while backing away from a lot of excessive sweetness and richness. So we thought to ourselves, how can we continue to fulfill those principles, but at the same time continue to work with local guys ourselves without having to build a giant sort of mold, like organization of several hundred people like Spike has, because we're just not as good at that part as he is.
We're young yet.
And so fermentation definitely became the answer. Fermentation's a great way to meet a grower or a maker on their terms, because if there's something out there that we want to eat that somebody's growing, you know, chances are something else wants to eat it as well, and so it's, you know, it can be fermented, and vinegar just happens to have been I think the part that is the part of what we do that's very approachable and can be quickly sewn into many restaurants and chefs' current programs, and so it's taken off much more quickly. It also happens to ferment a little faster than everything else.
It helps us work with the farmers, too, because oftentimes, I think starting at Woodbury, we got into the habit where if a farmer comes in and they have something and they're like, hey, we've got 10 crates of this. What are you guys going to do with it? Figure it out. And so that could get really hairy if you don't have fermentation. And it used to be that sometimes you couldn't deal with that. But now at this point, we kind of seek that out often. We don't always need the most perfect strawberry, or, you know, at the end of the season when the farmer has a ton of apples left over, great, love it. So that's kind of a...
Yeah, Chef Opie's actually sitting on a few hundred pounds of strawberries that got a little too much rain on them.
Seconds.
And I think we might go do some work on that as soon as we wrap up here.
You're going to eat first. And, you know, I owe... Sarah and Isaiah, a big thanks, because they know that I also tried to make vinegar once upon a time in the kitchen at Woodbury. I jumped right in. I got a 200-liter stainless steel tank, and I kind of had an old drawing of what's called a Fring's acetator, which is a contraption that can make vinegar a little faster than just putting it in a barrel, supposedly. And I got this thing going with some white wine from a local vineyard, and I hooked up, I had a circulating pump, an aquarium pump. Don't judge Josh. Josh can do anything. He's a nerd in the best possible sense. And I'm not. Anyway, I had this thing hooked up in the kitchen, and it was just bubbling away and attracting every fruit fly that grows around. It didn't work out, long story short.
It's really cool, though. Like, looking back now, I know, you know, after making vinegar for over a year now and really having no idea what I was doing, and now, like, I don't know, I think it was, like, month 8 where I got to what Spike was doing, and I was like, oh, okay, now I know what you're doing, because it's really, I mean, that's, like, advanced vinegar making, my opinion.
Anyway.
It was really, really cool.
Well, it's even cooler now that you guys are doing what you're doing, and we're able to take you know, at Woodbury, at Parts and Labor, Artifact. I think we're even using a Grand Cru, right?
Is that,
it's one of our favorite ingredients, and you're all going to get to try it. We've cooked with it tonight. It was, well, you guys made the pickles before, some of them, and that was it's just an amazing ingredient. How is it? I wanted to kind of, like, one of the things that we're focused on, obsessed with, I guess, is trying to take this approach and create a business out of it. And Josh, you maybe are further along with this than these guys, but how is it going? No, on the business side, I mean, you're scaling up a little bit. What's your production like at this point?
We're processing about 1,000 acres of oilseed right now. This is the first year ever that we're going to roll right from old crop right into new crop. We have really had trouble finding the right growers over the last, and also the financial end of financing all of that grain at the same time as I spent it. It's just me, and I didn't come from, I mean, this is it. Here I am. You know, this is all you got. So it's been a financial struggle at the same time to try to grow. And then I had this grand idea that I wanted to become a farmer, so I bought all this farm equipment, and it's hard to make money farming at first, but hopefully it's going to get there. But I don't know what you're asking me. We are growing. I mean, we're finding more and more people that get it, like yourself. Like, you were our first get it kind of person. Like, we were struggling with trying to make what the industry had already made when we got together. We're trying to, like, it used to stress me out. I don't care now. It doesn't matter what the industry makes. Right. We need to make what nature made and make the people that are going to consume that understand that's what it tastes
what
like.
What is it? What are you talking? Tell us what you're talking about.
Well, like canola oil, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, canola oil is, it's a brassica. It's in the mustard family. It has got a lovely, lovely flavor. But you'll never know. You can't go to the store and buy unrefined canola oil or raps oil, which is German for low-acid rapeseed oil. And you don't know what that is, because it doesn't exist in this country. It's not there. So, like, you should know that's
no one knows. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. So it's become, I don't care what like Cargill makes anymore. It doesn't matter. They can do what they do. I'm going to do what I do, and I'm going to find more and more people that get it for the right reasons. And it's much more satisfactory to find those folks. And it's growing tremendously. Or like sunflower, for example. It's the most amazing. It tastes like sunflower. I mean, doesn't that sound insane? But you can't go to the supermarket and buy sunflower oil that tastes like sunflower. You know, it's been manipulated or messed with or whatever. Even like some of the, you know, like more natural brands are not quite. There's nothing like that right there. It's buttery. It's flavorful. It was once alive. You know, all these crops I saw growing in a field before they got in that bottle. Like I could take you to the people that grew this stuff and introduce you to the folks that put their sweat and tears and blood into making this stuff happen. And I'm becoming, you know, we farm 200 acres now ourselves, among other things, and we're trying to integrate all those value-added grains. Like, for instance, soybeans. I grew non-GMO food-grade soybeans that these folks bought last year and made something that they haven't given me. I don't even know what they made out of, but
give it another year.
We're making soy sauce and our miso with it, but those both take at least 6 months, usually more than a year, so...
So
we're keeping them waiting.
Right. Like, we have a local guy in Williamsport that makes tempeh, and he makes these awesome tempeh burgers. And, you know, I'm a German guy. We eat meat. So that's what it's about. But, you know, just for, I got to tell you, the most satisfying sandwich, you know, I deliver oil to these people every week, and I happen to make it there at lunchtime. And let me have one of those tempeh burgers. And they are, so it's cooked in the oil that I made. It's the soybeans that I grew. I mean, I wish I would have grown the red wheat to make the bun to put it all together, because that would have been the whole thing. That's the whole package. And the satisfaction of that was just tremendous. So, like, it, where it started was all about this fuel, and now it's so much more than that, I guess. I'm going around it.
That's good. That's
so when you come
down to
an answer?
Yeah, that's an answer. When you come down to Baltimore, you're not just delivering to Woodbury anymore, right?
No, I've got several customers now. Like, we deliver to John Hopkins University. They use our oil in their commercial kitchens there. We've got some guys in the Chesapeake region that have little retail shops. They come up and meet me here. Ned Atwater is starting to use our sunflower oil and some salad dressings, and there's more people. Seems like my truck's never big enough to come to Baltimore. That's the
awesome
problem. Yeah.
And the 1,000 acres that you're talking about, is that those are mostly around where you are in Pennsylvania?
No. Like, I have a farmer in Reidsville, Virginia, that actually grew a tremendous stand of canola that should be harvesting it within the next 20 days. I really need to visit him. And then we contract some growers up into, like, northern Virginia, up into, we have a grower in Maryland, we have one in New Jersey. And I try to, because that's what it's about. Like, I have I sell oil to Princeton University. I have a grower that's 10 minutes north of Princeton University. So if Princeton University wants to go see where their oil comes from, we can drive up the road and look at their oil, you know, and the same thing with, you know, John Hopkins, whatever. We're trying to. So we grow quite a bit of acres in Pennsylvania. I also have contracted in some New York, but basically mid-Atlantic region. And as much as I'd love for it all to be, like, right next to me, it's too much at once. You can't handle that much grain at one time. So we try to stretch it out, and it not only spreads the work out, but also the financial burden of receiving those grains in. So,
canola is you plant it in the winter?
There's two varieties. There's a spring variety and a winter variety that's seeded in the fall.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So anything, you know, south of me generally as a winter variety, it's planted in September, October. It grows a little bit, then it goes dormant, and then the moment it's time to grow in the spring, it wakes up and done. And then usually north of me, spring canola is more. The winters are too harsh for the winter canola to survive. So that's usually all spring canola. So, like, where I'm at, I'm on the verge. I farm 260, 250 acres. Some of my farms are bottom ground. I can get away with a winter canola crop. And I have some mountain ground that we seem to feed a lot of deer. So I plant a spring crop so it grows faster than the deer can eat it. But, yeah, two varieties of that.
sunflowers. Yeah.
So Paige, for you, I know you've had at least one employee, right? You said.
Yes, we're up to four now.
All right.
I know.
So that's because when I was there, it was just Nancy and her little.
Yeah, me, Lewis, and Nancy.
And where is the salt fine? Where are you selling the stuff?
Well, parts and labor.
Oh, yeah.
Parts and labor, and I think y'all are going to start carrying it here at Artifact. And but we're in about 400 retailers all over the country. So if you're in your hometown, you can go on our website and look at our stock list and see where you can pick it up locally. And we also, of course, sell it on online, ship it all over the country. So.
And the idea for scale for you guys, what is it? I mean, you talked a little bit about how that you want to be careful about that, but what does it look like?
Well, you know, we...
And I just preface that, I guess, because where you are, you know, outside of Charleston, West Virginia,
right,
in that beautiful little river valley, was a major center of salt production, right, in this country.
Oh, right. In the 1800s, there were 50 producers with about 150 wells. The river that runs through Charleston, the Kanawha River, actually runs north, and it runs to Cincinnati, which back then was the meatpacking district. That's one way the settlers were able to push west so fast, to find a brine source, a salt source on this side of the Appalachian Mountains. So it was a huge find. And
why was that important?
To cure the meats. Uh-huh. There were no refrigeration back in the 1800s. The Dickinsons were the last family to make salt in 1945 of those salt operators. One reason was refrigeration had been built or discovered or... What am I looking for? Created.
And
invented, that's the word. So the use of salt had changed drastically. And they were boiling it back in the 1800s. They were boiling it with timber and coal. It was a very dirty job. And so they just needed to move away from that. So that's why we solar evaporate it today. It's much more environmentally friendly, of course. But... it was a huge production. We were the biggest salt makers in the country in the 1800s, right there in Malden, right outside of Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very important to our country and the way it proceeded and how quickly it proceeded.
So you guys might not get to where they were in the 1800s, but...
Yeah, not quite. We made 10,000 pounds last year, our second full year of production. We made 7,000 the first, 10,000 last year, and we're hoping to make between 14,000 and 15,000 pounds this year. And again, that's all hand harvested, and all that kind
we
of
get
stuff.
Two salts from you. Essentially, we get a.
We do. My sister-in-law and her husband are chefs, and so the consistency and the quality of our salt is extremely important to them. You're all's experience, not only your taste of it, but the crunch of it, is very, very important to us. So the later harvests produces a smaller grain, because if you go back to chemistry, there are fewer NaCl molecules to get together to form those crystals. We actually sift that out. So that smaller crystal, we call it a popcorn salt or cooking salt, is a finer crystal. The finishing salt that you have samples of and that you might have tasted out here tonight should have that nice crunch to it. So that also goes through a sifter, a screen, where we stand and sift and think of quicker ways to do things. the salt that's on top, we've now added the grinding salt. Folks have been asking for that, and we are. But that's all the same flavor of salt. It has the same flavor. When we started this, we thought we were going to flavor the salt with all these great flavors. It was just going to be so much fun. But then we got our salt and tasted it, and couldn't believe how bright and bold and clean it tasted. And what it did to food, you know, it won't make a bad melon taste good, but it'll make a good melon taste incredible. So we really moved away from that, with the exception of two salts that we've just come on the market with this past week, and you all have ordered it for Woodbury, a ramp salt, which is a big in West Virginia, and a smoked salt, an applewood smoked salt. We think those two flavors will complement the bright, bold taste of our salt beautifully. So we're excited about that.
You know, I think maybe my favorite thing to eat right now, and maybe ever, is a big, thick slice of the bread that Russell's baking at Woodbury, toasted with a little butter, and that's salt.
Yes.
It is just so good. I had a big piece of it today. Anyway, what does success look like for you guys? You're just getting started, and
we've been doing these fermentations, you know, pretty intensely for about 2 years now, but only have been operating independently and building our own business since January.
Mm-hmm.
Our website isn't up yet. So that gives an example of sort of where we are. So what's really nice right now is that we're able to continue to refine in a very agile way as results come in from the latest batch, our technique and our sources and what we're doing, how we get along with the people that come in, that sell us what we make our stuff from, and also where we are. I mean, Washington, D.C., you may know, is kind of square footage, a little expensive. We've been thinking about where we'll expand to in Baltimore. This Monday, we'll be going up to Pennsylvania to put a temporary, possibly permanent, commercial space together, very close to Adams County, which is sort of maybe the biggest producer of apples in the Chesapeake watershed, and certainly among the top five nationally as far as concentration. You know, any discussion of vinegar, actually, you know, of course, is really a discussion about sugar.
Talk about that.
Sure. So vinegar is acetic acid, or is a solution of acetic acid fermented from alcohol, and then alcohol, of course, is a solution fermented from sugar. So.
So it has two stages. First, you need to make alcohol, and then you expose that alcohol to air, and your acetobacter will come and take over and turn that into vinegar. It's the simplest way. So we have to start with something that has sugar. And Isaiah and I have kind of decided that one of our core beliefs are, you know, things that we really are going to adhere to. We're not adding any refined sugar to anything that we make. We're just going to use natural sugar. That's either found in what we're making or kind of added to it. For example, we'll use apple cider if we're making a vinegar. For example, the sumac doesn't have enough natural sugar, so we use a little apple cider to kind of kick it up to alcohol stage. And so, I guess, what were we talking about? Oh, so our sugar sources.
Yeah, so sugar sources really dominate the conversation of where. Or I should say dominate the logistical conversation, how it's going to get done, where we're going to be, and where things are.
And also what we're making. Aren't going to be making, you know, every single kind of vinegar. We're not doing a vinegar infusions type of thing. We're just going to try to keep the, you know, varieties really straightforward because it kind of is purity of flavor, too, I think.
So right now we have about a dozen clients, and honestly, we're turning people away because we're selling about as much as we can sell, and it's a pretty low volume. We both still have jobs, you know, outside of the company.
And I think that also is driven by the fact that, you know, with the process of vinegar, each batch that you make requires the batch prior. It genuinely grows. We're limited by space.
Explain that a little bit, too. What do you mean?
I don't know how much you guys are familiar with vinegar, but okay. each batch requires a mother, almost like a loaf of bread. So the yeast and bacteria is naturally found. I'm not adding any yeast to it. Some people actually do that. You can add yeast. I don't. So every batch that I make, once it turns into alcohol and I expose it to air, I'm going to give it some oomph from the batch prior. Some of that liquid and the mother itself goes into the next batch. So if you're making you start with 1 quart, then you go to 1 gallon, then you go to 2 gallons, if that makes sense. So I can't really, if someone were to come up to me and say, I need 600 gallons, I'd be like, that's awesome. I really would love to do that, but I need to make a little bit more first.
Which is exactly what I said the other day.
Yes. So, in fact, we have a 100-gallon batch going right now.
We're on our way.
Yeah, we're getting there. So you're kind of, for our success, I think we're limited by space and time. You know, every batch takes at least 6 months. And yeah. I can't rush it, and if I do, it's not as good. So
yeah, the slow pace of the actual process acts as a kind of natural brake on the pace of the growth of the business itself, which I think is a really neat reflection, and gives us a lot of time to continue to refine what we offer and how we get it to the point where we can offer it. And we're really enjoying that, knowing that, you know, maybe 2 years down the line, things will be a little crazier. But right now, it's sort of, we get to have our hands in every single piece of everything.
We've gone a little longer than we usually go before we get audience involved.
Well, first of all, my name is Andrew. Thank you guys so much. Congratulations on what you do. My question is actually for Josh. Particularly, grapeseed, canola oil, the kind of thing that you do, it's prized for its high smoke point. It's great for high heat cooking, frying, that sort of thing. Do the flavor compounds that remain in the high quality oil that you produce affect the smoke point? Is that something that Spike or any of the other chefs who work with your oils have found to be an issue? Or is it just absolutely delicious and still perfect for the high heat cooking that chefs need to do? Thank you so much for taking my question.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of those things that add those natural flavors will burn at a lower temperature than the actual oil would. Canola does have chlorophyll, it has iron, it has phosphorus, it has some complexes that are formed between phosphorus and some other metals. All of those things in a kind of more industrial application like a deep fryer will shorten the life. So that first time we cooked with that raw canola oil and made those turkeys, that was it. That was one time, it was over with. So, and this is part of the struggle. The commercial oil is chemically refined, it's chemically extracted, it's manipulated, it's bleached, it's cut down to where all of that stuff is gone. And I kind of struggled with that. Like, I didn't want to use chemicals. I didn't want to use those things that destroyed what the oil was. So I kind of by accident came up with a way. I found a clay that has an absorbent quality to it. It has a polar attraction to those prooxidants, those things that do burn in the oil. And we have it's kind of a very slow, matter of fact, the sales rep that sells it to me thinks I'm crazy for still doing it. But we flow that material through this clay, and it grabs some of that chlorophyll, and it grabs those phosphorus compounds, it grabs iron, it grabs magnesium, it grabs some of those things, and we get almost there. We don't make the same oil that Crisco salad oil is. It does have some of those things, and it will smoke, and it might foam more because we don't add anything to it that inhibits foaming. But what's also interesting about that is by doing that process, we also don't destroy the good parts of the oil that nature gave it. Like very high in vitamin E and A. I mean, those are powerful antioxidants. And if you don't stress that oil with high temperature or harsh processing, that stuff stays. So we're able to go almost all the way to what industrial customers like, with still kind of keeping close to the core of what we want to be. Now, we only do that with canola. Sunflower oil doesn't have chlorophyll in it. It has very, very low things that would smoke on its own. All we do with sunflower oil is, it's called winterization, which sounds really fancy, but we make it cold and we filter off the parts that don't look pretty in a bottle. That's all that is. You know, we actually create the higher viscosity parts of that fat and crystallize them, and then we filter them at 42 degrees, which makes this brilliant bottle. You know, it would be gross looking if it was in there. That stuff wouldn't hurt you, but it's just really for but sunflower really is really good for high temperature without any of that manipulation. Raps oil, which is the unrefined version of canola, it's got all that goodness in it. It's going to be good for pan frying. It's going to be good for, I mean, you could deep fry with it. It's just not going to last forever. I don't know. Am I answering the question correctly or no?
Absolutely.
Sorry.
I have a salt question. So what do you do with the iron once you leach it out? And you were talking about all the wells in your hotel in West Virginia. I mean, once you've gotten the brine out of them, are they finished or do they self-replenish?
So first, the iron. We have two byproducts of the salt making. The first is iron, which we collect. It falls to the bottom of the tank. At the end of the year, we don't make salt January, February, March. It's just too, it's very gray in West Virginia in those months. So we take that time to harvest the iron, which is a wonderful dyer. We've sold it to pottery folks to dye the glaze. We have a wool dyer that's bought some. Always looking for outlets there. We thought of once we'd do salt licks, but we don't have quite enough iron to do salt licks for animals. But we harvest that and sell it. The second byproduct that we get from salt making is something called negari. It's the liquid minerals that don't adhere to the salt crystals. Our salt is 94% sodium chloride and 6% trace minerals. So it's kind of lower in salt than other salt. But we collect the negari as well. It's traditionally used to make tofu. It's a natural coagulant. It will coagulate cow's milk and make a beautiful ricotta cheese in your kitchen in about 20 minutes. It's also just liquid minerals. It's very high in magnesium, which and other trace minerals, which are very important for us to have. And like if you do take a mineral supplement, if you take a pill, your body only absorbs about 5% of that, but the liquid absorbs 100%. So it's a pretty interesting byproduct that we didn't exactly know we were gonna get, but we didn't know we were gonna get as much as we get. Lots. We're swimming in it. You want some negari?
Yeah. Only knew somebody who grew soybeans.
Yeah.
Wait a second.
Okay. We'll talk.
Sounds like tofu is happening.
And the second question
was about do the whales replenish themselves?
The wells from the 1800s were actually hand dug. Took them 2 years to dig a well. Once they got deep enough, they would hollowed out sycamore tree down in the well, and sink a guy with a swing and a shovel and a bucket and keep digging. He would actually get so deep that he'd have to come up very slowly or he'd get the bends. It was crazy to think about that now. So most of those wells have just collapsed on themselves. I mean, they've just turned back into earth. We have one well that we hope never have to dig again. We hope it's going to last forever. but the Iapetus Ocean would have covered about a 5-state area if it were surface area now. It was a very large, shallow ocean. And it kind of pools in West Virginia. So, again, we don't think we'll have to dig another well. But if we do, we'll make sure we clean up this well site and leave it as beautiful as we found it.
And yours is the only active well.
Only active well in the valley now. Yes. So, thank you.
All right. I also am totally impressed. So I just have two, simple questions. Apples, you make your vinegar out of any and all apples? Does it matter?
We've got single varietals. I think is going to be a really important thing for us and really focusing on our blends. There are people who already know a lot more about that than we do. There are certainly some people who are starting to grow more apples that are cider-oriented, hard cider specifically. And I think those are the ones that are naturally going to find themselves to be more sort of vinegar-oriented as well, like all sorts of pippins and Roxbury is another great one. But, we've got a Gold Rush apple vinegar. We've got a Pink Lady. We've got a Granny. We've just started to do a sort of first half dozen experiments have come to
We picked
fruition.
Three apples that we thought, I mean, for this go-around, we picked three apples that we thought were really different and really liked for different reasons. Granny Smith we always liked for its tartness and super clean, and that maintained. Pink Lady, super floral, super sweet tasting, also maintained in vinegar form. And then Gold Rush, which I thought was just a really round type of apple, and that also maintained. So we're very fascinated and going to continue with single variety apple vinegars rather than apple cider, we think, just because apple cider vinegar is super awesome, but we love apples, I think, coming from the pastry kitchen. I've always loved apples. I'm from upstate New York, so definitely going to kind of follow that path for the time being.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Oil, it sounds like it goes from the field into the bottle almost immediately. It's
Well, I mean, there's some storage issues in there. Like, we kind of pride ourselves in maintaining a quality and ownership of that from harvest all the way to, right here. So I work with all of our growers that I don't grow myself. I work with those guys, and we work out. It can come out of the field and typically get cleaned very, very quickly and then brought down to the condition for long-term storage. So a lot of times there's some drying involved. There's a certain, they call it sweat. It doesn't actually sweat, but sometimes when you harvest the grain, it might be at one moisture and then it'll come out into another moisture and some aeration is necessary, but there's some care involved. And that's one of the things with, because I don't do harsh chemical
refining, I have to start with the very best to get the very best. So I can't have a subpar oil seed.
So if I buy a bottle and I have it on my shelf, is there a shelf life to it once I've opened it?
Well, it's a real thing. So in everything that's real has a shelf life for sure. And I usually tell people, don't buy a size that you can't consume in a year's time, which is kind of a broad statement. We have kept every run of oil we've ever made. We have a room. I haven't found the time that it goes bad yet. But that's a pretty, healthy, use it in a year, because I want you to come back and buy some more. that's kind of what it comes down to.
I have a question for Keep Oil Vinegar. Your sourcing is obviously so strict and so focused, and I guess I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the cultures whose traditions you draw on for preserving, even though you don't, even though you're so strict about the sourcing that the, what I'm asking.
Sure. I found out about the reason that the Philippines is so famous for making the sugarcane vinegar is that there's a sort of a limit to how much clean syrup you can press out of cane before you get something that needs heavier processing. And so what comes out still has sugar but ends up being much more suited to fermentation. So there's value there that if you're sticking directly to... or strictly to the first use of the product, is just not being taken advantage of. And I think many times when you find vinegar process around the world, you're finding something that is the use of a byproduct or the second use of an initial product. Yeah.
Most people, if you think of vinegar, you're going to think of, oh, I can just pour out the rest of this wine bottle, and then some restaurants, I think, do that, where they'll just kind of take the dregs of every wine bottle, and that's their red wine vinegar that they use. So we read a lot about all of these processes, and I mean, we're constantly reading, and, we were really focused on a lot of... Asian techniques with our soy sauce and our miso, and how we can kind of adapt those. I think that's the right word.
Yeah.
But vinegar is a pretty old thing. I don't think they really even know, or I don't know who they is, but if you look back, we're making bread and we're making alcohol, and of course you're making vinegar. So... in terms of cultures that we draw from with vinegar, we're kind of chasing sugar. So wherever there's sugar, you're going to find vinegar. I think with what Isaiah was saying, it is that sort of second use. And I think we really like that it's repurposing into something that can be really quite valuable.
Yeah. And so you find yourself kind of confronted with the fact that a lot of fermentation ends up being survival food. This is how...
Yeah.
Nutrients and calories are carried through the lean season.
And that was a lot with what we were kind of focused on too, was preservation. Your vinegar is not only a way of preserving the food, but it's also a way to preserve food. So that was really important to us.
So with that in mind, it seems kind of silly to box something into saying this is a Korean technique that uses Korean ingredients, or this is a Japanese, because none of those things are a static point in history. I mean, most of those kinds of long fermentations like miso and soy sauce that we traditionally associate with Japan, actually, there was a time in for about 1,000 years when those were done in China and had not yet even reached the island. And most of them kind of got there and took a detour through Korea on the way. And so you'll find an iteration. It's a great... example of how you'll find an iteration of the same idea expressed many different ways, 12 or 15 different ways from this super zoomed out perspective, what seems to us sometimes like a more homogeneous region.
You'll fish gets salt preserved here, and we kind of taste salt a lot too, honestly, with our preservation. And right now we're doing vinegar, but we're also obviously doing the soy sauce and the miso, and that has a lot of salt. And salt as a preservation technique, and sugar as a preservation technique as well.
So we may be at the end of an incredible conversation. And as I said at the beginning, we cook with oil, salt, and vinegar almost every day. Well, every day for sure. And today is no exception. We've got an amazing meal that David and I have been working on. And Isaiah and Sarah pitched in. There's going to be a salad, of course, with a vinaigrette. We settled on an old school dish called poulet au vinaigre, vinaigre. French isn't that great. Chicken and vinegar, and the vinegar is your celery.
Yeah, celery leaf
vinegar, which is beautiful. We started with we seasoned all the chicken with some JQD salt. This is what we do every day, but I'm explaining it for you guys. We sauteed the chicken, browned it off in canola oil from Cisco. No, from from Susquehanna Mills. And it's a great question earlier. At this point, it's the only oil we use, and we use it for frying. It's in our fryers. We usually have a fryer with Josh's oil, and then we usually have a fryer, especially at Parts of Labor, with some kind of animal fat. But we're sauteing with it on the line. It does wonderfully, and I think if you don't, you can't just blaze it at 700 degrees for 20 minutes, but you can't really do that with any oil. But we're very, very happy with the performance, I guess you could say, of Josh's oils for cooking, cooking in, which is what we did today. We browned the chicken from Bo Ramsburg in Josh's oil, and then pulled it out and made this beautiful sauce with a little bit of white wine, with a lot of vinegar, finished it with a little cream, and that's what we're going to have today, a classic French kind of bistro dish. And then some beautiful salads, some potatoes, beets, and other things that David has been working on as we've been in here talking. And I don't, what's dessert?
Vinegar pie.
Vinegar pie.
Yeah.
Of course. So,
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe a shot of Nagari. We're going to be feeling so good when we leave here.
Nagari too.
But I want to thank, this has been amazing. You guys are incredible what you do.
Thanks again for joining us tonight at Artifact for our Origin Speaker Series. With thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Mark Eldridge for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.